This is January 23rd, 2011, and I'm going to take up a koan today. This is in the collection of koans called the Book of Serenity or the Book of Equanimity. In Japanese, it's called the Shoyo Roku. And this is number 11 in that collection, and it's called Yunmen's Two Sicknesses. And this is how it goes. Great Master Yunmen said, "When the light doesn't penetrate completely, there are two kinds of sicknesses. One is when everything is unclear and things seem to hang before you. Another sickness is where you have realized the emptiness of all things, but somehow you feel as if there were still something there. This, too, is the light not penetrating thoroughly. Concerning the Dharmakaya, there are also two sicknesses. Though you manage to reach the Dharmakaya, you remain attached to the Dharma and do not extinguish your notion about it. This is one sickness. And even if you can truly penetrate to the end, but then let up, that won't do. Examine yourself minutely. If you find no flaw, this is also a sickness." So really he covers four sicknesses here. The first two are before enlightenment, and the second two are after enlightenment. Usually I begin a commentary on a koan by giving some biographical information about the master or masters who appear in the koan, but I won't do that today. This master Yunmen, or his Japanized name is Ummon. There are so many koans that he's in that that I fairly frequently am giving biographical information on him. In fact, just 8 days ago in my Teisho on the last day of Sesshin, I did this. And because we want to keep this Teisho relatively short, in deference, especially in deference to the workshop people, then we're just going to not comment on this, not except to say that this Yunmen, he and they're both Chinese masters. He and Zhao Zhou, his Japanese name is Joshu. These two guys appear together in way more koans than any other masters, and so they're really very illustrious Tang Dynasty masters. Yunmen was, I think, born in the 800s. He lived in the 800 or 900s. Zhao Zhou, a little earlier, I think. And together they are great, great lights of Chinese Zen that are also have held in great esteem in China and in the West as well. So these first two, before enlightenment, when the light doesn't penetrate completely, there are two kinds of sicknesses. First, let me just comment on that statement. When the light doesn't penetrate completely, well, when we haven't opened our eyes, when we are still to one degree or another, to one depth or another, still living in darkness, darkness about the true nature of things. One is when everything is unclear and things seem to hang before you. That's the first one of the four. Everything is unclear and things seem to hang before you. This is where we're caught in the world of form. Speaking very broadly, there are always two vantage points from which to see the truth or reality. One is from the side of form or phenomena, and the other is the formless, or the realm the realm of no form, or the realm of the absolute. 99.999 some percent of human beings see basically phenomena as pretty much the whole story. This is just the conventional way of understanding reality. This is the world of self and other, that I'm here and you all are out there. This is the realm of dualisms, the inside and outside, the realm of right and wrong, of time that is past, present, and future, space, here and there, us and them, success and failure, life and death. It's a state of sickness. One may or may not be aware of the sickness, but it's a sickness because one sees only half of reality, the realm of the relative. I suppose you could say that until supreme perfect enlightenment, we are all a little sick, but especially when one has not seen through this realm of form, then one has this, especially so. Hakuin, the great Rinzai Master Hakuin, once said, no matter how little sickness there may be in one's body, there is pain in his heart because there is delusion in his mind. This is a chronic sickness of all sentient beings. So, things seem to hang before you. For example, something more practice oriented? Well, pain. Pain can seem like such a thing, such a substantial barrier in the body mind, and so. It is a big barrier for beginners, less so later, but in the beginning it is so so daunting, pain and what is worse is the fear of pain. This is what beginners, all of us, almost all of us, struggle with in the early stages of practice. Pain seems so substantial, so real in a way, and so impassable. This is also, this first sickness is seeing enlightenment, the realm of enlightenment, as something apart from us. That's another duality that afflicts most people, is the notion of enlightenment as something out there, somewhere out there in the future that we have to get to, whereas what enlightenment reveals is that it is our very nature. It's not apart from us. A Chinese master put it this way: the ordinary person, by which he meant the so-called unenlightened person, the ordinary person the one who is enlightened the whole day long without knowing it. This goes right to the very bedrock of faith and experience in Zen. As we just recited in the Hakuin chant, from the very beginning all beings are Buddha. From the very beginning. But in this first sickness, when everything is unclear and things seem to hang before you, this has to be taken on faith. Until one confirms it through one's own direct experience of awakening to this truth, of enlightenment is not outside us, then it hangs before us. And this can become a real attachment. Before any kind of awakening, it's a real attachment to be hung up on this supposed state out there in the future that we need to get to. It's a major impediment, so long as we keep it in the mind, as long as we have it hanging in there in the mind, then we are blocked. We are caught in this dichotomy. And the same with the others. That related to that is success and failure. I'm a success if I come to awakening, and a failure if I don't, which can then engender fear of failure, which can cause one to hold back in one's efforts out of fear of failure. It can cause these same dichotomies. This world of dualism can engender all kinds of feelings of comparison. There's me, and there's her, or him, or them. We're on one side of the barrier, they're on the other side of the barrier. It also can bring in the element of time, where we think we're running out of time, we have to hurry, we've got to get there. Roshi Kaplow, when he admitted later that when he went to Japan, he just wanted to grab Kensho and run. Big impediment. But it's certainly not an insoluble impediment. It's one that is dissolved through intense zazen, that it becomes, it's a thought. All of these dichotomies are thoughts. And through zazen, we can get beyond thoughts. And when we do, we're beyond self and other, us and them, success and failure, time, space, right and wrong, and so forth. We get beyond the notion of enlightenment. But until we do, we can use this sickness. This sickness becomes our way out. Somewhere or other, I heard this wonderful statement: anxiety is like a match. Light it, and it'll show you the way out. So this is the wonderful thing that to the degree that we feel sick, that is dissatisfied, to that degree we will want out. We will want to find a cure. So you could say that the very dissatisfaction is itself, this embedded within it, or not apart from it, is the cure. That's what makes us strive to get well. Many of us, when we get into practice, well, I'll just speak for myself. I was just sick of myself. Sick. Of all the things that I did and said and thought, and it was a state of such misery that it became the medicine. Got to do something about this. I can't stand this anymore. So even in this so-called sickness, this first sickness, our enlightened nature is functioning. The aspiration is alive and well, and we are whole and complete even in our sickness. Even in our sickness, we are well, because we are longing for deliverance from this state of misery. It's a wonderful thing about one of the many wonderful things about working at a workshop, introductory workshop, is that you know that everyone there is there because they're dissatisfied. It's a great, great prognosis. Dissatisfaction. If we're complacent and completely satisfied with our lives and with ourself as we are, then there is little promise of change, of transformation. Now, not everyone who comes to practice is feeling any great dissatisfaction with themselves, but it has to be there. Otherwise, they wouldn't come. They wouldn't sit in these postures that are often uncomfortable in the beginning. Wouldn't go to the trouble of all this if there wasn't something they felt was missing, something not quite enough. The second, and then he says, the second of the four sicknesses. Another sickness is where you have realized the emptiness of all things, but somehow you feel as if there were still something there. This too is the light not penetrating thoroughly. Now, this is not really awakening to the non-dual nature of reality. This is having an experience of emptiness without it seeing it as no different than form. This is seeing emptiness as something apart from form. And our initiation to this perspective comes in Zazen, where we get beyond thought. Thoughts are forms. Thoughts are still in the world of form and phenomena. But with a very sincere and persistent effort, we can experience this realm in which we are free of thought. This is the realm we call emptiness. This spaciousness and clarity and profound stillness. This is a wonderful experience to have. It's still not breaking through this discursive consciousness that divides the world into form and emptiness and all these other dichotomies. And so we may experience this and savor it and never forget it our whole lives, but then because it is not the real thing, it passes. But the memory may still be there, and then we got a new attachment. The new attachment is that there is this realm of emptiness that is higher, better than the world of form. It's another concept. Now we got two to deal with. And this easily masquerades, this experience of emptiness easily masquerades as awakening. And that's why Zen teachers have a whole battery of questions with which to probe the student's understanding to see if it is this elevated state of wonderful freedom and joy and clarity that is just a conditioned state. It's just a temporary state based on this dip into the realm of no form, whether it's that or whether it's the real thing. And it can be very, very difficult to discern the difference. Over time it becomes more obvious, but like in a particular sitting, say in Sesshin, for a teacher to be able to discern that is not so easy, because the fact is that even a genuine awakening is usually very faint, very tenuous, and can be mistaken for the real thing. One of the great, great perils of the Zen school is passing someone who's had, who may have got into this state and is convinced themselves that they have had an awakening experience, and then it's a big mistake. It really causes problems up the road. This is what the Japanese call buji san, this second sickness or the second attachment, the attachment to emptiness. Buji san is having a glimpse into this realm that is beyond enlightenment and no enlightenment, and all the other dualisms, and it can leave someone with the conviction that there's nothing to do. There's nowhere to go. And this is a kind of paralysis, very pernicious state to get into. And so we have those in senior practitioners who've had some experience of emptiness, who very firmly announce that there is nothing, no world of enlightenment apart from the ordinary world. Or as one Soto Zen teacher put it on the West Coast, I don't give a shit about enlightenment. Now there are great masters who have said more or less the same thing, because they have really gone beyond this. There is a genuine, deep realization that informs that kind of statement, that I don't understand the Dharma. I don't understand enlightenment. That's one thing. Or as Bodhidharma, the founder of Zen, said, I don't know. But it's a very different thing to have just had this glancing peek into the world of no form, and then announcing that you no longer have any use for the awakening experience. This is a great blight on Western Zen, as I've heard that it also is in Japanese Zen. And then as a result, you have all kinds of people becoming teachers who haven't had a real insight into the formlessness of form. The great Joshu had one of these guys to contend with, or a student came to him, and he said, if I haven't anything in my mind, what shall I do? And Joshu, seeing that there was still a notion of something in his mind, he said, throw it out. And then the student said, but if I don't have anything in the mind, how can I throw it out? And Joshu said, well then, carry it out. But these attachments can be so subtle. And now as we go on into the third one, the third sickness, they could be called the four attachments. It gets even more so subtle. And here's what we hear from Yunmen. Concerning the Dharmakaya, there are also two sicknesses. Let me first say for new people what the Dharmakaya is. Dharmakaya is another word for Buddha nature, basically. And you can have scholars debating the fine nuances between these words. And there are a lot of terms. The more you study the Dharma the texts, the more you realize that there are a lot of ambiguity and disagreement among people what these terms mean. One might quibble about the difference between the Dharmakaya and Buddha nature, but basically it means this realm of emptiness that is no other than the world of appearances, the world of phenomena. It's the realization of this realm of Dharmakaya that prompted the author of the Lankavatara Sutra, one of the great Zen, great sutras esteemed in Zen, to say, things are not what they appear to be, nor are they otherwise. Concerning the Dharmakaya, there are also two sicknesses. So now here we're talking about after awakening, at least a first, possibly faint experience of awakening. Though you manage to reach the Dharmakaya, you remain attached to the Dharma and do not extinguish your own notion about it. This is one sickness. These koans, they originate in China. The Chinese language is very imprecise, and the koans, the wording of the koans, therefore, can be quite vague and subject to quite different translations. Here, when he says you remain attached to the Dharma, one way to understand that is attached to the notion of the Dharma as a thing. Now we're beyond seeing emptiness as a thing, but now we've made the Dharma into a thing, and it's not a thing. When Rinzai was asked, "What is your realization?" He said that when hungry, I eat; when tired, I sleep. This is the baffling paradox of Zen and the realization of Zen is that the world of thingness and the world of no thingness are not two. That It's like one of these templates, you know, in an art book, or maybe a book of maps. You sometimes find a plastic page, or more than one maybe, that you lay over. It has a certain simple design on it, and so you lay it over, and you see something in a different way. Well, Zen is like that plastic sheet that you lay over reality, but there is no design on it. It's there's nothing there. Dogen, too, the Japanese Zen master Dogen, when asked what he realized in his 9 years of rigorous monastic training in China, he came back to his home, Japan, and he was asked this, and he said, "My eyes are horizontal and my nose is vertical." But the inevitable consequence of awakening is to, I think it's inevitable, never known it not to happen, is a sense of having attained something. Okay, I've got it. and others don't have it, but now I've got it, and it's wonderful, and it's great, and so forth. This is what in Zen it's called the stink of awakening, where there, and this stink, this odor of pride or having attained something, is a reflection of an imperfect understanding. It's still thinking that there's something called enlightenment that's apart from what everyone is equally endowed with from the beginning. It's sort of the similar to the first sickness we went through, but now it's inverted. But what they have in common, the first sickness and this third sickness, is still separating in one's mind the concept of enlightenment and non-enlightenment. And many of the koans deal with scouring one of this clinging to these concepts, because that's what they are. They're concepts. They're notions. If a more mature development of enlightenment, it leaves you seeing that you've gotten nothing that you didn't already have, and that everyone else doesn't already have. There's nothing you've gained, because you had it from the beginning. One of the great statements by Dogen, Zen Master Dogen, that is possibly repeated more than any, is the following. He said, to learn the Dharma is to learn about oneself. To learn about oneself is to forget oneself. To forget oneself is to perceive oneself as all things. To realize this is to cast off the body and mind of self and others. When you've reached this stage, you will be detached even from enlightenment, but will practice it continually without thinking about it. And so we also have this saying in Zen, just be ordinary, or there's nothing special about it. There's so many koans, and koans are mostly dialogues, stories involving dialogues between two masters or a monk and a master, and there's so many that show this swagger that can come after awakening, and it's especially strong after a deep awakening, contrary to all sense. You know, you think, okay, deep awakening means you've seen clearly through self and other. And yet there is this residue that isn't so easily expunged from the mind, this residue of self and other that takes so long to cleanse the mind of. This is where post-enlightenment practice is so important, because we've been carrying around these notions for so long, starting with enlightenment and non-enlightenment, but all the others too. They're so ingrained in our minds that just a single glimpse into the formlessness of these concepts isn't enough to really change us completely. Roshi Kapil used to say that a Kensho experience doesn't transform you, but it establishes the basis of transforming you. And the Chinese masters and Korean masters and Japanese masters who hammer away at this, that you must continue practicing after awakening to clean up And so Yasutani Roshi put it this way: one has to get rid of all concepts until nothing remains. Then one has to rid himself of the idea that there is nothing. It's like doing cleaning with a bucket of water. After you have made everything spotless, you need to dispose of the dirty water that remains. There's a story, a famous story in Chinese Zen about a great enlightened hermit who would be in such a deep state of absorption and purity of mind that the birds would come and bring flowers to the master and drop flowers on his lap there in his little hut in the mountains, or sitting outside his hut. But then he had one great final experience, a deeper experience of enlightenment, and the birds stopped coming. There was nobody left. No one special, no one glowing with charisma. He had become completely transparent, spiritually transparent. And then the final of the four sicknesses: and even if you can truly penetrate to the end, but then let up, that won't do. Examining yourself minutely, if you find no flaw, this is also a sickness. I don't know that I can speak from experience about having penetrated to the end, but I can speak from experience about seeing ever more subtle forms of self and other in the mind. And this isn't just a lifetime of work. This is lifetimes. This is what Dogen meant when he said there is no beginning to practice and end to enlightenment, and there is no beginning to enlightenment and end to practice. This is the sickness of someone who might feel, I've wiped away every cloud in the sky. Even the notion of myself as enlightened, this is gone. There's really nothing left to do. Sick, sick, sick. Still some dirty water there that hasn't been pitched. And so I think probably this sickness, one is more vulnerable to this sickness, would be more vulnerable to this sickness if you were alone, living as a hermit in the mountains, where you didn't have relationships, where you didn't have others to make you aware of your flaws, your enduring blind spots. And that's one of the great practice points of living in a community, living with other people, is that we're always going to find something some, at least a little bit of friction with someone or other, and usually with several or more than several people, maybe lots of people, depending on the circumstances, the stress involved in the circumstances, we're going to find ourselves rubbing others the wrong way and vice versa. And there we have a great, great arena of practice and of noticing the remaining sharp corners to our personality, the rough edges that have yet to be polished down. The worst thing, the great loss of this opportunity is when we blame others for the conflict, for the difficulty. This is very common human tendency to just simply blame the others when we have trouble with them. But someone who's really practicing, and certainly anyone who has seen at all through this illusion of self and other, will not be content just to blame it on the other person, but will turn this lamp of the mind, turn it around and look to oneself. How am I contributing to this? What is my responsibility? And then you might come say, oh no, but this person is just completely outrageous. What she's saying, what he's saying, what they're doing, this is so, so bad. But then look again. Oh, wait a minute. We know this much, that you wouldn't have difficulty with that person if you were not, if you didn't exist. So there's something there, just by your being there, by your being existing in relationship to that person, there is a little responsibility. But then beyond that, if we search our hearts sincerely and look how we may, even maybe just the most subtle way, it's not always 50-50. We know this. There are people who are outrageous, who are disagreeable and playing out their own neurotic issues with everyone they come into contact with. But it doesn't have to be 50-50, but somewhere in there, there's some, maybe, look, just look, there's some responsibility that each of us has for the difficulties. And that's the measure of someone who is really, really, with, as Dogen said, someone with a mind that seeks the way, is when you're always turning the light back to yourself and looking at how I might be contributing to this. This is where marriage becomes such a great vehicle of practice, is you have this other person who knows you so well, and theoretically loves you. And from that ground of love and trust, to appreciate how the spouse or one's partner, how he or she is a mirror, how, again, that person can have his or her own issues, and it may not be the most perfect reflection of oneself, but to have the trust to listen to what your partner is saying, and again, to look at the flashpoints, which can be incredibly petty in daily life, but to look at those and I would suggest, I'm coming up to 20 years of marriage now, to don't even think about trying to change your partner. It's such folly. That's not our work. Our work is to change ourselves. It's not our partner isn't our project. You know, there was this long running play at a local a small theater in Rochester called I Love You, You're Perfect, Now Change. It was a great play. So it is really a terrific thing in relationships, whether it's intimate relationships or other relationships, to always be aware, looking. Let's look here. What's going on here? How am I contributing to this? How can I change? Never mind the other person. He or she, that's their job to change. But mine, it's myself. This is where it starts, changing myself and learning where to stop being so stubborn and opinionated and attached to my notions of how people should be. Examining yourself minutely, if you find no flaw, this is also a sickness. Well, that covers that koan. By the way, I didn't give away anything in this koan that would be related to the demonstration or presentation of the koan. For this koan, there are four parts to it, and with every koan, I make every effort not to give too much away, so that the student will have to search herself in order to know how to demonstrate the spirit of the koan. All right, we'll stop now and recite the four vows.